Oh, it's my intro. Holy fuck. All right, hold on here. I gotta get in the zone. I gotta get in the zone, John. I gotta do my intro.
Get in the zone.
Unless this was my intro.
Oh, what a twist!
Hello and welcome to the Punk News Podcast. This is episode, 370? I didn't announce it in my clever intro, but it's episode 370. I'm Adam White. I'm recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on the program this evening, out of parts unknown East Coast, Mr. John Gentile.
I thought I was watching the M. Night Shyamalan movie. It's like Adam White was talking about the intro, but it actually was the intro. That's right up there with, Sixth Sense and... The Amish one with the zombies and rubber masks and stuff. Everybody knows the zombies and rubber masks movie.
Yeah, I remember that movie poster. The Amish one. Yeah, that one. There was a twist in it. Anyways, yeah, so what are we talking about? This is Punk News Podcast. You're John. I'm Adam. On the other coast, Mr. Ricky Frankel.
Hey, guys. I was supposed to be here last week, but screwed up everything. But I'm here now.
You were, and I was supposed to be here last night when we were supposed to record this, and I wasn't because A, I was at work for a long time and I was tired, and then B, when I got home and I thought to myself, can I power through this and just go record the podcast? I was walking down the stairs, and I may or may not have been looking at my phone, but that doesn't really important to the part of the story. And then I stepped on a little metal tractor that my son left on the stairs and flipped and like hit... Like landed with my shoulder on a handful of the steps and I got all fucked up. And then I was like, fuck this. I'm not talking to John Gentile. I'm going to go watch Netflix. So that was my evening.
What did you watch?
My wife and I finished watching Iron Fist and we finished watching Master of None. So we're just finishing things, John, getting them done.
I watched Batman, the animated series last night.
Like the whole thing?
No, like two episodes. Oh. The Cat and the Claw, part one and two. And, I'm not going to talk about Batman the Animated Series. I was about to go into like a 15-minute rant about how much I love Batman the Animated Series. I hate it. Listen, boys, the point being is, I've been observing and examining kind of the hot podcasts, and I just don't get it. Like, there's a couple of podcasts where we're like, oh, it's a great podcast, and they're just like two jackasses just like talking about nonsense with like no direction whatsoever. And it's like, I don't find your personality appealing, and I don't give a shit what you're talking about because you're not talking about anything. At least with the Punk News Podcast, at least we talk about something, even though it's minutia. It's a small minority people care about, but at least we talk about it. At least we have direction. I just don't understand why certain podcasts are popular. I really
honestly
don't.
There's one. You know, one of the other podcasts that I listen to religiously, they really have their shit together. And it's with Paul Scheer, June Diane Raphael, and Jason Mantzoukas. They're all involved. They're all involved, like the show The League. And it's called How Did This Get Made? And it's just three comedians plus a comedian, a guest that's also a comedian. And they just rip on a terrible movie. And it's hysterically funny.
How Did This Get Made is the enemy of my movie.
Really?
Show.
I didn't even know there was another one.
Well, there's a huge movie show on the Max Fun Network called The Flop House that's been going for years. And it's a bunch of guys that used to, one of them is a bartender, but the other two of them used to be Daily Show writers. One of them still is. And the other one is now writing Mystery Science Theater. And right when the Flop House started, just at around the same time, like in a really early episode of that, one of them came on and was like, so there's this other podcast called How Did This Get Made? And it's like our exact same premise. And there was for a while, they were staring at each other with squinty eyes across the
screen. I didn't know that.
Like Maggie and that baby with the unibrow. whenever they see each
that's
other.
That's really weird.
Welcome back to the Punk News podcast, where we weren't going to talk about Batman the Animated Series, so instead we're talking about movie-themed
other podcasts that are better than this one.
Whatever.
Those podcasts are not better than our podcast, Adam.
Astonishingly. Astonishingly, John, but that's okay.
Why do you always neg our podcast?
Because if you take our podcast and you add several zeros to the listenership numbers, then you get to these podcasts. So I'm just going off some empirical
those
evidence.
Those podcasts are also
rudimentary
sponsored,
peni,
too. They get paid.
Rudimentary Peni sold like 1,000 records, and they're basically the best band ever. And by contrast, like Pearl Jam's U2 sells millions of records. So popularity is not indicative of quality, Adam. Why, as a punk rocker, I would think you would know this.
Well, actually, here, I got an idea. Let's just do what those other podcasts would do without permission. So midway through this show, I'm going to do an ad read for Casper Mattresses, and it'll be fucking awesome.
And okay. And then one for Squarespace.
Yeah, and then you do a Squarespace one, Ricky, and then we'll just do them, but we don't want their fucking money.
No, we just want them to succeed, motherfucker.
Yeah, because we love how they're disrupting the mattress industry, and John, they have just the right sink and just the right bounce.
Yeah, and do you,
I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Do you not listen to podcasts?
Not really. I don't. I listen to like a couple.
This is your problem, is that you have no fluency in this genre that we're trying to explain.
Well, I listen to these popular podcasts. I'm like, this is freaking garbage.
Oh, John. Don't worry. We'll do a Squarespace ad for you later. It'll be great.
And I can do one for
It'll be an offer code. We'll come up with the offer code. So anyways, yeah. So this is the Punk News podcast. No one sponsors us because we suck. And we are going to talk about...
No one sponsors us because we're cool and have credibility.
We haven't fucking sold out, man.
So anyways, we're going to, I suppose, talk about a bunch of news that happened this week. There was a bunch of songs. There was a bunch of actual... news of substance, I guess. At least in the first half of the show, there is. But before we get to that, because we have Ricky back, we're going to do some record collecting talk. So if you don't like us talking about record collecting, skip like 17 minutes ahead. Just hit that like skip 30 seconds button on your player a number of times.
Record collecting is one of our most popular features on the Punk News podcast, Adam. Why are you negging our strong points?
Measured with what? What's your metric for this? Anyways, but before we do that,
let's Adam White watched that show, The Pickup Artist, with that guy Mystery, and he's like, the way you get women to like you is you neg them. And so now Adam like is trying to pick up the podcast or something by negging it.
That's exactly what I'm doing. But before we do that, I'm skipping over our own little schedule here. Let's talk about some mail, John. Anyone write in?
Oh, yeah. We actually got some good mail, but let me pull it up. Give me a second here. So somebody talk about something while I pull up our mail.
So because we're going to talk about records here, I had a couple that I picked up the other day and I hadn't taken the wrap off of them. So I just did so I could look at a few details. And now my cat is running around the floor under my mic, attacking the plastic. So if anyone hears that, sorry.
Adam, let me ask you a question. Do you have a blog? Do you need to share recipes? Because if you need to, can I recommend Squarespace?
Okay, listen. You can always reach that podcast. We got a podcast here. We're not selling, I don't know. What do you guys sell? Microwaves or something? I don't know. This is podcast@punknews.org. You can always reach that podcast@punknews.org. This is from Dave. Dave's written in multiple times before. We like Dave. Dave says, hey guys, this is in reference to an older episode, but I've been binge listening to a bunch of episodes that I've saved up and have just heard because he likes the podcast, Adam. You claim that the Misfits reunion at the Forum was a theater-sized venue in LA. The Forum is actually the basketball arena that the Lakers play in, and it holds about 18,000 people. When I first heard about this, I also assumed it would be at some large theater, but you can see it listed on the venue's website between Jay-Z and the Shakira concert. I would suspect the size of the place and the number of people who have to get paid perhaps plays into why the tickets are so expensive for the Misfits. And actually, Dave does bring a good point. I kind of always assume that, like, with these giant things, the reason it's so, like, Billy Joel plays these giant venues and it's like $200 a ticket. I always assumed he charged that just because he could, but maybe you really do have to charge that much to make some money. I don't know.
Well, wait a minute. As the person that lives in Los Angeles, this guy got something wrong. The Lakers, I think the Lakers used to play at the Forum. They don't play at the Forum. They play at the Staples Center.
Is that really that relevant, Mickey?
You know what? remember that you just mentioned Billy Joel, because I'm going to bring him up later in the episode.
Okay. Well, anyway, thank you for the tip. And I do think the Misfits are making tons of cash on this. And I don't mind them making tons of cash. I do wish it wasn't $150 a ticket. I wish it was like 60 or 70. But what are you going to do? This is from Neil, the Liverpool Neil, who's always berating us.
Oh, good.
Hey, guys, let me start that I love the new Angry Ricky. Love it. Keep it up, Ricky. There's nothing wrong with having strong opinions. Keep it coming, mate.
Thank you.
It's been a while since I wrote in last, so I have various thoughts on a few things from the last months of podcasts. First off, not to bring this up again, John, but you keep saying that Billy Idol was a roadie for the Sex Pistols. He wasn't. Was he an early fan? Yes, for sure. But I've never seen or read anywhere else that he said that he had roadied for them. Sex Pistols roadies were Nils Stevenson and John Boogie Tabiri. It's not in his biography and not in the bios of any of the Sex Pistols or in any other of the dozens of punk books that I have read. So please tell me where you got that info from. Otherwise, it's fake news. Okay, Liverpool Neil, I will find my source and I will counterattack, because I'm nearly sure that Billy Idol was a roadie for the Sex Pistols, at least briefly. Now, the thing I did want to talk about is related to a guest you guys had on a few episodes back. It was the guy that was opening a record store in New York that only caters to rare punk rock vinyl. Now, I have lots of issues with this whole thing. First, the guy was talking about how cool it was that old punks would come in and shoot the shit about old school punk bands like, wait for it, Quicksand. What is that? Old school? I was expecting a quick Dead Boy story or a Johnny Thunders mention, but Quicksand? Neither old nor punk. So that interview got off to a really bad start for me. And then he mentioned some of the punk records he had in stock that he considered rare. I was expecting some classics. Anarchy in the UK on EMI. Damn, Damn, Damn's first press with the photo of Eddie and the Hot Rods on the back instead of the Damn. Buzzcocks, Spiral Scratch, first press. Stuff like that. Instead, he listed off a bunch of new crap on colored vinyl that I wouldn't consider rare at all. But far worse than that, and this isn't a problem with the store specifically, these are records that are specifically pressed to be limited and to be collectible. And that raises huge, huge ethical questions for me. A rare record should be rare because it was either super limited press on a small label, or because the record was put out with a mistake or was withdrawn really fast so that there simply aren't that many out there. Making 200 of a certain color of a record and charging more for it specifically to make it collectible is horseshit in my opinion. So I think a decision has to be made between records that are truly rare and collectible and records that are just put out in limited color ways just to make the band more money. That annoys the shit out of me, if you haven't guessed. Not to mention the fact that colored vinyl sounds worse than plain black, as I explained in another email of mine from a year ago. I'm not really ragging on the store owner. Anyone operating a new record store is fine with me, and I love the concept. But to suggest that some of the records that he's stocking are rare is simply not accurate in my opinion. As an example, Hot Topic has exclusive limited color pressings of certain records. Are those considered rare? You all may laugh at the crass commercialism of that, but isn't it the same thing? Anyway, enough of me. Until next time, as always, stay free from Liverpool, Neil.
I like just letting Neil's opinions just sort of hang out there. I mean, Quicksand is probably an old band if you're like a 14-year-old or something. I don't know. Everything's relative, right? Certain bands are old bands to certain people. You didn't just list like some rare punk records. You listed like a few of the rarest. from a historic standpoint. You listed a punk record that was a plot point in High Fidelity. It was so rare. So like, yeah, you're not going to open up a record store and just have one of those kicking around. You can go throw on the display shelf. So, the 14th color of a Hot Water Music record is all you're going to be able to do. So I get that. I mean, the very thought of having to stock a store with exclusively rare records seems like a terrifying amount of
risk
to me, I guess. But, you know, that's why I'm not doing that. So, hey, all the power to the record store guy, all the power to Liverpool Neil for being an angry old crotch. That's great. I'm okay with all that.
This is from Camillo. Camillo's written in multiple times. He says, good evening. First, I forgot to write back to thank you for your thoughtful response on my email regarding politics. It gave me some stuff to think about as well. Honestly, boys, I don't remember that. I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, I'm sure we talked.
I think this might have been the guy that said that asked us why we don't talk about politics more. That's my guess.
Oh, yeah. And then we just told like whole groups of people to fuck off, and then we moved on.
So I know I'm a few episodes behind, but I think you guys are kind of missing something with respect to the why of Prophets of Rage. This is good. Initially, it seemed like a one-off thing for the election because nobody thought Trump would or could win. However, with him in office, I think a lot of people are figuring they need to do whatever they can to be part of the resistance. So if we're looking for the motivation, I think that's about the sum of it. They figure that what they can do is add to the soundtrack of musical opposition to the Trump regime. I don't think there's much else to it. Now, whether they are correctly reading the moment and whether their songs are vital are other questions entirely, to which I think the fair answer is a hard, maybe not, from Camillo. Camillo coming at a different angle than you, Adam. Why? I would say he's a little bit persuasive.
Yeah, sure. I mean, academically, he's persuasive. His read on this probably isn't wrong, but every time I listen to a Prophet of Rage song, I want to go to sleep. So I don't know what can I say?
Yeah, actually,
that's the bare minimum, is that I cannot pass into a different state of consciousness.
I'm actually reviewing this. This is on my deck to review right now, this album. I won't talk about, you can see my thoughts on this band in my review of their first EP. But I think Camille's right. But I think there's probably more to it. They wouldn't be doing this if this wasn't viable and to make money. And I think that first EP that they put out, was quite, the ripoff for fans. Also, you know, I think it was late December. If you go back in the Punk News podcast feed, I interviewed Tim Comerford, their bassist, because his other band, Walk Rat, put out a record. And I asked him, I said, if Trump hadn't have won, do you think probably, I asked him something along the lines, if Trump hadn't have won, would Prophets of Rage still be a thing? And he said, yeah, he would, because he had his own issues with Hillary Clinton. So I think these guys just saw an opportunity to revitalize what, you know, some sort of version of Rage Against the Machine. They're not doing a good job, I don't think. There's a lot of money in anger. Okay. And these guys are trying to profit off it. And actually, if you go,
I don't think they're making that much money.
Yes, I think they are. Because I mean, at least from concerts, they have to be, because they're selling out everywhere. But and it actually, what's interesting though is there's I mean it's not just Adam and me that are ragging on this. If you look at the iTunes rating reviews of the new record, it's a 3 out of 5 collectively.
Do you really think that Chuck D and Tom Morello sat down and said, how can we make the most money possible? Let's start a super group that's terrible. I don't think the money is the main motivation here.
That's oversimplifying it completely.
You just said that's their main motivation.
I think it's one of the main main motivators, but here's the thing. They're clearly capitalizing on a very tumultuous political year. And
sort of Rage Against the Machine.
I think Rage Rage were different. They were I think Rage could have started really politically speaking, they probably could have started in any decade. Now, musically, probably not. I think the 90s were, you know, that's when that rap rock thing started, and they were the only ones doing well at that.
I can understand, yeah, skewering Prophets of Rage for their music because they're just not that. They might be awesome live, but I'm a huge Public Enemy fan, just not that much of a fan. I just don't understand why you seem to be attacking them on the virtue angle or the sincerity angle. I think they're as sincere as Rage Against the Machine or Public Enemy.
I'm not seeing it. Also, the other thing is, and the reason why I say that, John, is if you listen to it, these guys sound bored and tired, and they sound like they're just kind of,
because they're all like 55 and 60.
Well, then they shouldn't maybe be doing this, but they're not. But what it sounds more like is that they're just kind of phoning it in. I think this was just an opportunity for a bunch of different things. Money's definitely one of them. You know, more power to them if they're capitalizing. I think there are different political bands that are doing it better, for sure.
I agree with that. I think there's other political bands that are doing a way better angle at their stressing their politics. Yeah. Anyways, you can only
if you never if you never want to hear us talk about Prophets of Rage again, PayPal $5 to Adam at punknews.org.
That's what we should do, is we should start talking about terrible things and have people pay us to stop talking about that. That'll be our angle. You can always reach us at podcast at punknews.org. Let's talk about some record collecting. Who's going to kick us off? Ricky?
I can, unless Adam. I mean, Adam, you sounded like you were ready.
Oh, go ahead, Adam.
I mean, I'm ready. Like, my body is ready. We could do this, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. So I've been mail ordering stuff lately. I haven't been in a store in a while.
Have you been having fun, Adam? Mail ordering?
Yes, John. I get the reference. And this is my secret too. If anyone wants like a pool of money on which to spend on records, and you don't actually want to spend money that you should be spending on like food for your children and things like that, here's my advice. Go dig out the box of like Super Nintendo games that you have under your stairs and go through that box and fucking sell that shit on eBay, because we are right now at peak like 90s nerd nostalgia, and people want that shit. They want it if it's in the most garbage condition. So I have right now in this like PayPal account, like a couple $100 US just sitting there that was at one point my childhood video games that I'm now turning into records. So every time I mail order something now, I don't care because it's not real money and it's wonderful. So I'm buying things that I would normally not buy because it would seem expensive to me. The example for that, the bigger example of that for me was, so there's a guy that I played on the podcast several episodes ago. This crazy, super prolific garage rock guy out of Montreal called Paul Jacobs. So Paul's this guy that like in 3 years has released 6 albums and 3 EPs and just keeps putting stuff out like a madman. And he, none of it's ever actually been pressed on vinyl except for now. So he has this, his latest full length is something called Pictures, Movies, and Apartments. And it was just put out on like some limited run of like a couple hundred records by a UK label called Stolen Body. And this is one of these things where, you know, for me to go and to transfer my money into pounds and then order something from the UK and have it shipped on, I assume, a dirigible over the ocean to me, that's a very expensive proposition usually. But this was just like fucking video game money that wasn't real. So, you know, boom, that's in the mail. It's on the way. The other thing that was just released on vinyl after having been on just digital formats for a long time, and I'm really excited to get a copy of this, is that there is a Toronto-based independent like alt electronica group called Holy Fuck, and they put out an EP earlier this year called Bird Brains that is just super super just earwormy, just like thumping, you know, electronica stuff, which is normally not my thing at all, but there's something about the way that these guys do it that I find super fun. But anyways, though, the Bird Brains EP was just put out by a US label called Innovative Leisure that I know nothing about, but I sort of get the impression that in the electronic music world they're a bigger label maybe. But in any case, it's sitting there in the weird warehouse in Niagara Falls, New York, where I ship things to. And actually, that was the source of the tweet. It was, John, it was my most successful tweet of all time, almost.
It was. You got the most retweets?
Oh, so many. There was a, when I was checking this record out of their store, it was like, this record costs like, I don't know, like $12 or something. And they're like, where do you want to ship it? And I put in like Niagara Falls, Ontario. And One of the options that came back for shipping it from wherever in the States to Niagara Falls, Ontario was like $87. And the cheapest way to do it would have been, God, I'm trying to find the tweet right now, but it was like the cheapest way to do it was at least 2 or 3 times the price of the record. And then if I switched it to Niagara Falls, New York, which is literally, you know, you could shoot a bottle rocket at it from Niagara Falls, Ontario. The price to ship it was $2.63. So, like, Jesus.
I'm looking at it right here, Adam. I'll tell you. It was $21, $80, or $90 in Canada, or $15 or...
Ricky, are you angrily stomping on a...
No. Oh, I was... What is this? Oh, noise? Sorry, it was a... I have a bag of Halls here, sorry. Just a cough drop.
It sounded like you had a freight train of Halls. Sorry. Okay, but anyways, yeah. So, like, you want to pay $90 to ship this thing, or $2. It's insane. This is why... I don't know. I don't understand how people that don't live super close to the border in Canada can do this.
I don't know how Canadians don't understand the wonder that is media mail in the United
Seriously.
States. Seriously. Hence $2 yeah. shipping. I love media mail. Media mail is amazing.
Yeah, even... I mean, I usually don't... I mean, for records, I don't pay... I never pay more than, like, $10. And that's expensive.
Is there some weird historical precedent to media mail? Is it one of these
yes,
things
there is.
That like it only existed because like at one point like Taft lost a bet and then it got written into, you know,
media mail
founding document and enshrined.
Media mail was created by FDR as a way for libraries and other public institutions to ship documents back and forth.
Wow, okay, I wasn't that far off.
The idea being to make education cheap and educate people, something we don't see in the United States these days. However, media mail actually generally costs the post office money for two reasons. First, people mail stuff that really like records that really aren't educational but still technically fall under media mail. Also, there's a huge amount of scamming in media mail. Like Adam, you won't understand. Not that you won't understand this. You wouldn't know this. But in like, let's say you mail what's something you might mail to like a college student, like chocolate bars and socks, right? Regular mail that might be like $9, $10, $12. Media mail it would be like $2 or $3. So people lie and say it's media when really it's not media mail. So the USPS is losing money. More recently, they've taken a cracking down inspecting packages, but still it's a money loser because they don't catch most of the stuff. And actually, one time I sold a bunch of don't ever sell comic books on eBay. Comic book buyers are the worst buyers there are. I sold a whole bunch of comic books on eBay to some dork, and the post office guy said, I have to check it. So I said, all right. So he cut open my box. He completely destroyed my label, and they were comic books. Then he sealed it back up and mailed it, and I got negative feedback because this asshole was mad that the label was broken. Anyway, moral of the story, never sell comic books on eBay because however bad you think record buyers are, and generally I find that record buyers aren't that bad unless they're OrgCorp buyers. Comic book buyers are the absolute worst on eBay.
But there is one thing about media mail. It does take like usually like 2 weeks. It takes a lot longer than normal mail. So that's actually probably the only drawback to it. But
I think of it this way. Like we have socialized healthcare. You guys have media
mail.
Just
get your boy Trudeau on it.
Yeah, my boy Trudeau is working on wearing fancy socks and looking hot.
I saw
you had Chewbacca socks on last week. That was a big thing.
Oh yeah, it's adorable. That's the one thing, and that's the weird thing about Trudeau is that even people up here that don't have a problem politically with him, everyone's thinking like man, just like. Can you turn this off?
I see. Like, he's cute.
Dial
cute.
It back.
Is he
dial it
is
back?
He,
just
is he cringy?
Bit.
I think what Adam's saying is I think he's cute and he knows he's cute. Is that what it is, Adam?
It's like we all know he's cute. Doesn't need to prove that he's cute anymore. But he feel like he keeps doing things to remind us that he's cute, and it's exhausting.
That would drive me fucking crazy.
That and he's promised a good deal of electoral reform and then reneged on that, and his paying a lot of lip service to the plight of Indigenous people in Canada, but he's not really doing a whole lot. But hey, outside of all that, he's just really it's just the cringy like the sock thing. Like
hey,
come on,
Adam, you want to trade? We can trade.
Oh, Ricky, talk about some records.
Okay, let me get the old Instagram going here. I should give a shout out to the guys at Pirates Press. I've done a couple premieres for them on Punk News. I think I did Cox Bar for them, and then most recently a band called This Means War. And one of their guys, Christian, he sent me an email thanking me, and I said, "Oh, no problem, man. Like anytime." And he says, "What's your t-shirt size?" I say, "Oh, I'm a large." He says, "What's your address?" And I tell him. like a week and a half later, I get this fucking like crate of vinyl, flexies, two t-shirts and stickers and a record mat. It's a slip mat, like slip a Pirate Press slip mat. The guy sent me like at least $200 worth of free stuff. And I got like three Cox Bar records on vinyl. And so it was super unnecessary, but very cool of him. And so I wanted to just thank him on the podcast because it was so cool of him to do this. I got stuff from Noyce, and I got that This Means War 10-inch. So thank you, Pirates Press. That was very cool of you guys. I really appreciate it. I'm still not done listening to everything because there's a lot of stuff there. So I also have not been to a record store in a while. I go on my birthday, which is not for a few months, but I haven't been to like Amoeba or anything like that recently. I've gotten some records signed at shows, but nothing to, but it's just been mostly like, pre-order stuff. But I did want to talk about, I actually got something that's not new. I got something old. I got an original. I've been looking for this and kind of, it's been like at the bottom of my list, sort of waiting to be bought. I got the Clash's Complete Control 7-inch from 1977 on CBS Records. I love that song, so I'd been looking for that for a while, and it's in really good condition too. So that was cool. That was actually a rare eBay buy for me too. And then recently, I got the Eradicator, that Kids in the Hall band. Themed band. They have their record coming out on Stonewalled. I think it's, or is it coming out? I don't know if it's already out yet or if it's coming out soon. Well, I know it's soon if it's not out yet. And I pre-ordered it, and right when that link went up, and I got one of the white copies, and there were only 100 on white, so. I'm very happy with that. And the album's really good. You should check it out. These guys are funny, and they're kind of like the aggro pop punk thing that sort of like Direct Hit does sometimes. Like they kind of do like hardcore with like pop punk elements. That's kind of what these guys do. But yeah, I know we're only doing two each. So those are my two for this for this episode.
Oh, I thought we usually did three, so I'm going to do four, actually.
No,
go ahead, Ricky. Take your third, okay. Ricky. Take your third.
Let's see. Something from Discogs. I got, I saw the Dirty Nil with Against Me a couple weeks ago, and I wanted to complete my collection, so I got their Cinnamon 7-inch from Fat Records, but I found it on Discogs. That was like the white splatter on orange vinyl. And yeah, I after seeing them again, like I'm totally into them now. It took me a little while to figure it out, but I gotta tell you, Adam, these guys were quite the find. And actually, at the show, I managed to get, I ran back out to my car after the show ended, grabbed my record, my minimum R&B record, lied to security, told them I forgot my phone in there. And then just went to their booth, and they were all there, and they were cool enough to sign my white copy of it, which is really cool. And those are my three. How about that?
I was just looking at my copy of Cinnamon, and it is not fancy. It's just a black vinyl. I mean, Liverpool Neil would be totally stoked, but it doesn't look. I saw your Instagram photo of that, and it's cool. It's got this nice sunburst thing. It is nice. They just announced a pair of shows that are. They were years ago in the habit of doing these Christmas shows, and they are bringing them back this year. So they're playing two shows in Hamilton on like December 28th and 29th. And I don't know if the pre-order is still on for them, but if it is, you can get like tickets for like $10 a pop. There's like an all ages show and a 19 plus show. I will be at the 19 plus show. So if you want to punch me in the face, that's where you should go.
So this was my first time seeing them with Ross, and I got to tell you they're still great. They're still fantastic.
Did you make Ross sign minimum R&B that he doesn't play on?
I didn't make it. He offered. I didn't make him, but he knew who you were. We were talking, and he said, I said I write for Punk News, and he says, "Do you know who Adam White is?" I'm like, I said, "Yeah, of course. I mean, we're on the podcast together."
That's really weird. Again, like I've been to 700 shows where Ross is in a band or there in the crowd, but I don't know if I've ever said three words to Ross. So that's kind of weird.
Okay. All right. Well, there continue. You go. Hope it's awkward at the Christmas show.
He'll probably be playing. So, you know, I should just interrupt them.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Adam White from Punk News. Anyways, John, what do you got? Come on.
Well, I'll talk about awkwardness in a minute. However, unlike Adam and Ricky, I have been to the record store, and I recently picked up the 12-inch single of Kraftwerk's The Robots, but this is not the version of The Robots from like 1977, 78, The Man Machine. This is the version they did in 1991 off the Mix album, which I believe is a combination of the original recording and new recording on top of it, where they make it a maxi 12-inch mix. I haven't listened to it yet, but you guys know I love 12-inch singles. I love how they play at 45 and has such a large, powerful, booming sound, and I love the giant art on the 12-inch single. I have not listened to it yet, but I'm excited. The Robots by Kraftwerk. Do you guys like Kraftwerk at all?
I don't think I've heard them.
Adam, you know Kraftwerk, right?
Oh, yeah. I know Kraftwerk. I'm never sure where I'm oriented on Kraftwerk because I can absolutely identify like the songs that have like worked their way into commercials and pop culture things and stuff like that. But they're one of those bands. I'm not sure where to go. Right.
Yeah.
I don't know where the hell this to start. On Kraftwerk.
I will help you with Kraftwerk. I do generally enjoy Kraftwerk, but their songs are like, Computer Love's like Computer Love, beep, beep, beep,
yeah.
Computer Love, beep, beep. And sometimes I'm like, why am I listening to this? You know? But then sometimes I'm like, yeah, man, this is groovy. Anyway, Kraftwerk is considered the forebearer and maybe the first, electronic band, but not electronic in like dance music, electronic and kind of like, this just we almost it's not like punk, just it's very unique. It's proto electronic music is what it is. Check out The Man Machine and Trans Europe Express, then check out Computer Love, then check out Autobahn. All great albums, but the first one to check out is definitely either Man Machine or Trans Europe Express. Both great albums, and they both generally will explain to you when you listen to them why Kraftwerk is important and interesting and clever. Second thing that I got was the other thing that I got was this year has been the year of John completing his Punk 12-inch collection. I completed my Black Flag original press 12-inch collection. I completed my Misfits original press 12-inch collection. I finally got a copy of Amoebix's No Sanctuary 12-inch, which of course was their EP they put out on Spiderleg Records, which of course is Flux of Pink Indians. And it's them kind of before they fully found their sound. So it's a good record. It's not a great record, but it's got a very interesting angle and buzz to it, and also it's just cool anarcho-punk stuff, and it's the first anarcho-punk band. What was the other record that I wanted to talk about tonight? So anyway, generally I haven't found anything that good. You see on like Facebook and Instagram, people are like, man, look at these Ramones records I got at some guy's garage sale for $2 each. I only had that kind of thing happen once in like 1998 before I knew anything about records, and I got like three records, and I should have just bought every record the guy had. I shudder to think what he had at the time. I didn't know what he had. I bought a Joy Division record and a Damned record off the guy for $1 each, and he must have had like just an insane collection, and he was selling them for like $1 each and 7 inches for 50 cents each. If I know what I know now, I would just say, here's $100, give me everything. But listen, hindsight's 20/20. So since then, I haven't really found any crazy scores at record at flea markets or garage sales at all. You see these people have these crazy scores. I don't think I've ever really found anything that crazy at a flea market or a garage sale. However, for whatever reason, I've been finding the past couple weeks, I found three guys that were selling 80s and 90s hip hop, some pretty crucial hip hop releases. And I guess the most interesting one I got was the first Schoolie D album, the original press, which is the original press of Schoolie D's first album, PSK, What Does It Mean, original press, pressed by him, which is very rare. And of course, Ricky and Adam, do you guys know why Schoolie D's first album is considered a very important record?
Nope.
It's considered the first gangsta rap album. Ice-T says so, Ice Cube says so, Run DMC says so. It's considered the very first gangsta rap album. And it's primitive in that it's very sparse sounding, very hard hitting, but it's a cool, interesting record and just kind of a cool hip hop thing to have, especially since it's so rare. Last thing I want to mention is it will probably be for sale by the time you hear this. If not, be sure to check out the Punk News Bullshit Collector mixtape. It's Dirty Bands, Posers, Crazy in the Brains, Narboots, DFL, Hiccup, Drew Getz, Ellen and the Degenerates, cool, Teenage Bigfoot, Drones, cool band after cool band after cool band. You can pick it up online or at your local store. Check out the punknews.org site. I've just finished mixing it, and honestly, the Punk News Bullshit Collector mixtape is awesome. Let me talk about the fest I went to last weekend. I went to East Coast Tsunami Fest, which is like it's weird. It's like not it was like not advertised at all, and it's kind of like this is Hardcore Fest Part 2, and it was like it was literally like 20 hardcore bands, but like almost every band except for the last two bands played to basically no one because like all these hardcore guys they like to say oh I love hardcore I listen to hardcore. But like when there's more than two hardcore bands, all they do is hang out in the parking lot and party and hang out. They don't actually listen to the bands. So the point being that there's a lot of posing going on in the hardcore world. One of the more interesting things, and Adam White and Ricky, I don't know if you have a comment on this, 25 to Life played, and I didn't want to see this, not because I like the band because it's an interesting dynamic. Lead singer of 25 to Life is Rick Healy. Rick Healy has probably severe mental issues, possibly severe drug issues. He was either kicked out of the band or whatever. He's not in the band anymore, though he did write the lyrics to all the songs. He hates this guy called Stickman. Stickman is in a band called Fury of Five, and he's kind of more famous for getting in fistfights than he is for his band. They hate each other. They diss each other all the time. Stickman actually wrote a hip-hop track about how much he hates Rick Healy. The weird thing is, they did it at This Is Hardcore Fest, but they also did it at East Coast Tsunami Fest. Rick Healy, I mean, Stickman, is now fronting 25 to Life, which is weird because he's singing all of Rick Healy's lyrics. And during the whole show, he's like dissing Rick Healy. And it's a weird dynamic. You see what I'm saying?
It's a weird dynamic, John.
Well, I guess these two aren't impressed. I also saw Integrity. I just think it's weird that like you front a guy's band that you hate and you sing all his lyrics and then diss him, but like seem to sing his own lyrics.
It is weird. It's like wearing his underwear.
Maybe he's like, this is the best way to. What's the better way to piss that guy off?
I get it. But you know, like the battle's over. Stickman's won. So, but he keeps bringing up Rick Healy. And so it's like, well, the battle's over. Why are you fixating on this guy if the battle's over and you won? To Stickman's credit, he sings about beating people up a lot. I saw him in person. He is a very big dude. And I definitely believe he beat up a lot of people. He's big. I mean, he's a big guy. I also saw Integrity. Integrity was awesome. They played a bunch of new stuff. They were awesome. Go see Integrity if you get the chance.
All right, so I guess we should play a song and then we should get into what we actually have to get into, right?
Yeah.
Anything else we wanna do before that or?
We were talking about records. Like, let's hit these two quick stories as quickly.
Oh shit! Yeah. I had missed that. Yeah, these are important stories because these tie directly into the record collecting thing. I think, John, do the Screamails one first because it is less hilarious.
Okay, this is just kind of cool. It was kind of, I guess you could call it a promotional stunt, if you will, but it's cool. Screaming Females put out a new track. It's called Black Moon. It's off their upcoming album. The album doesn't have a title yet, but I bet it's going to be cool. Anyway, they released 20 copies of the 7-inch single, or no, it was 24 copies, 20 actual copies, 4 test presses. They released them in a record store in their original hometown, wherever Rutgers University is. I forget where Rutgers
it's
University
is. It's in New Jersey,
is.
Isn't
that,
it?
Yeah, I'm saying the town, though. Not Bridgewater. It's near Princeton, wherever Rutgers is. They did 24 copies, and that was it. And basically, by the time everybody heard about it, it was already sold out because there's only 24 copies. I think that's cool. I mean, I just think it's cool to make something hyper-limited for the people that are most likely to be fans to be able to go and get it. What I was very surprised about is how much hate the Screaming Females got. Where is this coming from? Like, I thought everybody loved the Screaming Females. I love the Screaming Females. And I think as a band, they're pretty unimpeachable. I think they're – even if you don't like them, you guys say, well, they're at least a cool band. People are, like, hating this band. What's up with that?
I know. I think that's a cool – I think it's a cool idea. Now, the thing is, like – and I'm pretty much what you described. I think I remember seeing them – did they perform on the Chris Gethard show once?
Twice or yeah, three I mean, times, and actually they even performed in a different time as their alter egos that nobody realized except for me.
Listen, I don't listen to them almost ever. I listened to this song, it was cool. And I totally respect their live show. I've never seen them live in person, but what I've seen though is quite cool. The 24th, I don't have an issue with that. Probably, I don't. And John, I don't know if you've looked this up, but were there any flippers involved in this?
I actually did look it up, according to Discogs, none were sold. When I checked eBay, none were sold.
So. Well, hopefully those are genuine fans that got them. I think now whoever got the test presses though, those are going to be those are the finds.
Why were people hating on the Screaming Females?
I think this is a cool and creative idea. It takes a lot of time, especially now, to put something on vinyl out. So I think this is a really cool idea that took quite a bit more dedication than I think people realize. So I think this was neat.
True.
Their new song is cool too. Are we talking about that now?
Well, I briefly mentioned it.
Yeah. Yeah, but you talk about the record, the new song, and why people are hating them, which I don't understand.
Is there more than just hate from Punk News in the comments?
No, just
Punk News. Then, you know. Well, okay.
I would imagine that the hate that you saw in Punk News may have been because it was predicated on this like super rare release thing. And people are not so much going and listening to a Screaming Female song and giving an insightful comment on that one way or the other. They're just going and being like, you know, who are these assholes who think they can release a rare stunt thing? We've determined, John, that people don't like it, at least on Punk News, when anyone does anything that is sort of for the sake of being funny or weird or goofy or interesting. People don't like that. People want you to, you know...
Wear flannel and sing about
being wear flannel and release like 300 on red vinyl and 300 on blue vinyl and fuck off. And that's
so true. That's cool. But releasing 24 is not cool. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. The new Screaming Female song is interesting. It's got less of a huge hook than I think a lot of the stuff on Rose Mountain did. So like on first listen, it grabbed me less than I would have expected a new Screaming Female song to do. But given what they were saying they wanted to do on this record, which was be a little bit weirder and a little bit looser, it makes me really interested to see where the record goes. So
Word on the Street, very trippy record. Word on the Street.
Yeah, so that, you know, I'm looking forward to that. I like the Screaming Females, John. That's all that really matters.
Let's talk about
someone no one likes right now. So this is a story that we keep coming back to because we like to see people fall.
And, I think John just likes to shit on this guy, to be honest.
No, John has decided that if he taunts this person enough, this person is petty enough that they will respond to John Gentile personally.
I mean, the guy's is like a YouTube live streamer. I bet he would come on if we asked him.
Except that he's in jail. So 2 years ago, the Wu-Tang Clan sold a copy of Once Upon a Time in Shaolin to a wealthy unknown buyer for a whopping $2 million, making it one of the most expensive records ever.
Not one of the
most expensive record ever. So a few days later, of course, it was revealed that the buyer was convicted fraudster, ruthless drug baron, and all-around D-bag Martin Shkreli. So we don't need to go into the sordid history of Martin Shkreli, but he is not in a good place at the moment in that he's in jail. So anyways,
he's not in a good place.
No, he's not in a good place. So earlier this month, he decided that he's going to sell this one of a kind, never heard by anyone else album on eBay. The sale wrapped and the album sold for $1 million. $1,025,100, meaning that the investor caused the release to lose half of its value in a 24-month period. It's still the world's most expensive album, but you know, there's $1 million gone. So the new buyer has not been confirmed, and it's unclear if that money is actually ever going to take place. I don't actually know what happens. Like, can you just go and just put like a bullshit bid on eBay for something? No, like, is there some sort of consequence?
I think they have to verify it after a certain amount of, after a bid is at a certain amount.
I don't, when I was selling those expensive Red Hot Chili Pepper t-shirts, I had so many fake Japanese bids. I was fighting against them every hour, literally.
How?
How? Because some guy would bid like $400. I'm like, that's cool. And then like the next bid would be like $20,000. And I know that's fake. And so I would click on the guy and I would see that he's got a history of it, or it's like the same guy using different accounts because it's the same physical address linked to it. So I have to like send a message to eBay and fight back. And that actually cost me sales because people that may have bid wouldn't bid, you see.
Gotcha. Anyways, so right now, Mr. Shkreli, he's in prison. He's awaiting sentencing after being convicted on 3 counts of securities fraud. Now, he was out on bail prior to sentencing. Is that called bail at that point?
No, that's not bail.
That's not bail.
Bail is prior to conviction.
That's just like you're not going to murder anyone, so you can just kind of hang out until we decide where you're going to go.
Yeah, I don't know what it's called. I guess I think it's just called being awaiting sentencing. I don't think you're technically out on anything.
Yeah, you know? So he wasn't incarcerated in any case. Right. But then he got thrown back in the clink because he went on the internet, and because this guy can't shut his mouth, he offered to pay people to steal hair from Hillary Clinton's head. And the authorities have decided that you can't go and encourage that kind of thing. So he's back in jail. So anyways, John, you're very amused by this. I'm amused by this. I'm convinced, John, that you personally are trying to start a beef with this guy.
I'm really not. That might be. I don't think I'd come off looking good in that one. So I'm actually interested in the story of this fantastic record. As a record collector, I think it's interesting to follow the history of the world's most expensive record. And even though it's, well, I guess when it originally sold for $2 million, you could argue it's not really worth that. It's just a hype value. It's not really worth that. But now that it's sold for at least $1 million, I think there's no way around it. It is worth at least $1 million, making it the most valuable record in the world.
I wonder if we can ever find out what happened. John, interview Martin Shkreli. I mean, you've interviewed.
I would interview him. I would.
You've interviewed like
worse people than him.
All sorts of fucking monsters like that.
Him. Yeah, we should have the John Monster collection on Punk News.
Here's a question: When I interviewed Satan, is Satan worse than this guy? Because Satan is a jerk, but this guy may have caused people to die and is literally profiting off people's sickness. Who's worse, Satan or him? I don't know.
Did he cause people to die?
Well, listen, he profited off people's sickness that upon penalty of death if they don't pay for his money, you know, pay for his product.
I understand that like taking a drug that people need and pricing it at a horrible rate is like a totally reprehensible thing to do. I didn't know if he was actually like, you know, if someone drew the line between that and someone that didn't actually get the medicine. But any case, that happens. So that's that's a hilarious story. I don't really know where we go from there. So
I don't, people are defending, like people think he's a good guy. Like
who thinks he's a good guy?
I'll tell you who. This guy right here, Bill, he caused the album to lose money in 24 months. The fact that he's a typical big pharma guy has zero impact on the value of Wu-Tang. Wu-Tang just doesn't hold value. He created the value by paying what he paid. He paid too much because no one else was willing to pay that price. He didn't cause the album to lose a cent. His ad regarding Hillary's hair was a joke, a play on the fact that Hillary openly engages in voodoo rituals. Yes, this is verifiable, even in recent news. So this guy clearly likes him. And there's other people. Like, if you go on Facebook, there's people that like him.
He does have he has quite the following, but not in our circles. I mean, he does. I remember seeing.
So someone just argued that Wu-Tang doesn't hold its value, like it's a fucking like it's a Toyota or something. And you're like, oh, it doesn't hold its value after you take it off the lot. After a couple of years, it just the resale just drops for this one of a kind crazy fucking item that I don't know how you make that kind of statement. Like, oh, like based on past evidence of me selling Wu-Tang stuff for not $1 million, I hereby judge the value of this one to be X, Y, and Z. That seems kind of crazy to me. All right, I'm gonna play a song so we can keep rolling here because we have
quite a bit more.
Yeah, charge your iPhones. So okay, anyway, so there's a label in Canada called Label Obscura. They're getting ready to reissue the self-titled debut record from a band from Montreal called The Nils. So The Nils released a self-titled album in 1987 on the label called Rock Hotel Records. Now, Rock Hotel was an imprint of the New York City hip hop label Profile. So this band goes, they sign a 5-year deal with Profile, basically. This big hip hop label that goes, picks up this rock band out of Montreal. They record their debut album for them. They go out on tour. And then while they're on tour, Profile files for bankruptcy and throws the band's contract basically in the pile of bankruptcy chips to be traded around. So all the money that the band was supposed to pick up from to be able to tour from the label evaporates. So the band can't tour. Then they can't actually record because technically they're still under this contract, which now is being held by, I don't know, the bankruptcy limbo. And they were fucked. They fell apart. They lost their momentum. This is one of these bands that when they were around were there was some list or something that Rolling Stone published in, I guess, the 87 or whatever it was. And they're listing these are the top, what was the term for it back then? The top college rock bands. And they're like, oh, they got the Replacements on there and they've got Husker Du. And I don't know if the Pixies had kind of started up at that point and were known, but in any case, they're listing all these bands now that are huge and The Nils were on there. And then The Nils just got fucked by this contract blow up. So in any case, the band story gets worse from there, but I won't get into it. But so Label Obscura has gone, they have remastered and are repressing, 180 gram vinyl versions of The Nils self-titled. It's got some new art for it. It's actually got liner notes that have been written by Jack Rabbit of The Big Takeover. So it's a cool little thing that they're putting out. So I'm going to play a song from that record, from Montreal's The Nils from 1987. I'm going to play... All right, this is a long episode. John, do I play a 3-minute song, a 1-minute song, or a 5-minute song?
5-minute song. 5-minute song.
5-minute song, hit him.
All right, so that's good because this is my preference out of the three. So this is a song called Bandito Calling off of The Nils self-titled record. If you look at any of the shit that's written about this band, they're constantly being talked about as a band that influenced, say, what Green Day went to sound like. So, see if you can hear that because it's cool. So here you go. All right, we're back. That was the Nils with Bandido Calling off their self-titled record that is being re-released. I mentioned Rolling Stone a second ago. John, let's talk about Rolling Stone here. That sucker's up for sale. What's the story?
Yeah, man. I'm bummed out. Rolling Stone is up for sale for good. If you recall, last year, Jan Venner, who founded Rolling Stone magazine, I guess just about 50 years ago, sold a 49% stake to an overseas company, the idea being the overseas company would have their own Rolling Stones in different countries. Venner is putting up the magazine for sale total, so it'll be 51% of the magazine, I guess. Basically, his son said, publishing is a completely different industry than it was. That's not a great quote. Venner also sold Men's Journal and US Weekly recently. A lot of people are saying he's probably not going to get what he wants out of it just because publishing is on the way out, or physical publishing is on the way out. And people think he's probably not going to get nearly what he hopes to get for it. Rolling Stone magazine, of course, has been a hallmark of rock and roll journalism, political journalism for the past 50 years. And I'm sad to see it go and or change. But I do think this is probably the end of the line for the magazine. Content-wise, it's been shrinking and shrinking the past 6 or 7 years, unfortunately.
I was looking back. I was pretty fired up about this. And John, this is no disrespect. This is just a difference of opinion. Okay. I cannot wait to see this thing go away.
I don't see why.
Kids do not read this stuff. The kids are watching Philip DeFranco and getting their news from him on YouTube. Okay. The main thing that I used to be indifferent with Rolling Stone, I'm sort of in between. Like, I'm, you know, My mom used to tell me about reading Rolling Stone, but I wasn't like, I was sort of in between, like it was there. I never really got into it. I never really read it except for a few exceptions. The one thing that will forever kind of be the stain on Rolling Stone's legacy is the UVA rape hoax article that was 100% debunked. And I think that and the way they handled it, and they're still being sued for it, I think, for millions. And the way it was handled was so abominably shameful for any sort of for journalism. And believe me, and I actually looked into it later on before this podcast. The Columbia School of Journalism were so angry with this. Like the top journalism school in the country, like just could not believe what happened. If you want to hear more about what I'm talking about, I don't need to go into it. Look up on Google. It's called A Rape on Campus, I believe. And it turned out to be a complete false, a complete fraud. And they, the person that wrote it did not check her sources. And it was a big mess. It's still a big mess. And a magazine like this to do something like this was so reprehensible, especially with all the amount of decades of work that they've done. I think it is time for them to go. That's all I have to say.
I think Ricky's wrong. Nope. I think he's wrong in that that one article stains their legacy. Listen, Rolling Stone's got 50 years of journalism. They've got 50 years of progressive journalism and giving a stance, a form of people that did not have it before, both in the political world, both in the music world. Their interviews are unparalleled. Playboy has got excellent interviews. Interview Magazine has excellent interviews. I think Rolling Stone generally is the best, all things considered. Also, though, GQ and Esquire have good interviews too. They screwed up that one thing. Certainly they did. But
you can't just say it was like.
Relax, Ricky. Relax. Right. Relax. Don't have a nervous
I'm
breakdown.
Not. I just said.
It's one thing. They've made incredible strides. I mean, Rolling Stone invented modern music journalism. So every music journalism there is, you know, Spin, Q, Vice, Noisy, MTV. It's all because of Rolling Stone. Till this day, their political articles are great. Their investigative articles are great. Their music interviews are great. So I think it's a real shame. And I think people that attack for that one article, they screwed it up. But I think people are actually attacking something different. If you have one screw up over 50 years, that's not too bad. It seems to me people that are attacking it are really just don't like, I guess, Rolling Stone or Jan Venner's general position. And so it's a different story.
They ruined lives.
Not
yes,
really.
They did.
I mean,
they ruined lives. Lives
they ruined.
They're still getting sued for it. I mean, that was a big deal in 2014. I remember it.
Whose lives did they ruin?
The people that were accused.
Do they name anybody?
They did not. That's true. But still, the whole thing was inexcusable. I think, and it's.
So that's one thing though, Ricky. Every magazine has something to screw up.
Article, like they doubled down way hard on it. And
out of 1,200 issues, you got one bad one. That's pretty good. You know what I mean? I don't know why you're taking such issue with that one thing.
It's also the other thing was if you read through the history, like the kind of oral history of it, there was basically no real apology for what happened. And for a screw up like that, that's inexcusable. I'm sorry.
Who are you to judge them? Who are you to say it's inexcusable or not excusable?
For a screw up like that, I think.
Yeah, it's not you. You weren't affected, so you don't get to decide.
No, but for them to hold themselves up in such high regard, and on some sort of pedestal, and then not at least just say, yeah, we screwed up. I think that's inexcusable.
I don't. I think if you look at all the good they've done and all they invented modern music journalism, one bad article doesn't wipe that out. And I think people that say, oh, they did this one thing, they're ruined forever, haven't really put in the work to understand how that kind of thing can happen. Hindsight is 2020. It's easier said than done. Adam White, drag us out of this hole.
Yeah, all right. I'm going to drag us out of this hole. You guys can have that one. I'm not going near that. So anyways, the Misfits, we talked about them earlier. So the original Misfits, original in quotes here, have announced a Las Vegas show. This plays a little bit into what we were talking about on a few episodes ago about whether they were going to keep doing this or not. And I mean, this is only a sample size of one, but they're at least doing another one of these. So anyways, the Misfits, billing themselves as the original Misfits, which includes Glenn Danzig, Jerry Only, Doyle, and Dave Lombardo on drums. They have announced a show in Las Vegas at the MGM Grand Garden Arena that's going to take place on December 28th. They are playing with Fear and the Alkaline Trio.
That's a great
lineup. That is an interesting lineup. But anyways, so the Misfits are at least doing another one. So if you miss them at Riot Fest there and you can get to Vegas, this is a second chance. I am dead fucking convinced that they're going to do more of these,
for sure,
because it seems dumb of them not to. But hey, if you're worried, here's your opportunity.
All I have to say is if I don't know if the tickets are on sale yet. If they're not, just scramble and get them, because I missed my chance to get the LA tickets and now they're on StubHub for $400.
John, have you did you get them? Did you catch the Misfits at the something?
No, I should have went to Riot Fest and I didn't. But honestly, knock on wood, I don't think they're going to come to Philadelphia. Danzig always plays Philadelphia. I hope they come around. I'm not going to fly out for this because, you know, listen, no concert's worth $1,000 or $1,200. Two quick questions. First, the LA show was advertised as the only show of 2017. So did they kind of defraud the consumer? You know what I mean?
I didn't even realize that. That's a good call.
That was kind of like, this is our only show for 2017. But a week later, they're like, all right, we're doing a second show. You know what I mean? But nobody's really complaining, I guess. Second, a lot of people were kind of confused by the lineup. I'm not a huge Alkaline Trio fan, but Alkaline Trio certainly is a huge Misfits fan. So, I mean, it makes sense from that. And I like how Fear is playing because, you know, Fear is an old school, you know, tough, edgy punk band. And that fits right into Danzig's style.
I wonder on a show like that, does Danzig actually have, and I say Danzig because I assume that he's the one that's really throwing his opinion around here. Does Danzig have any say on who the openers of that is, or is that all just up to whoever's booking it?
I'm thinking he does. I'm thinking maybe he throws the idea past people because he is notoriously not a control freak, but he wants shows to be what he wants them to be. So he usually picks the openers for the. I know he picks the openers for the Danzig shows. So I'm thinking for this, he's picking the openers. One other thing that I did want to point out is I was having trouble reconciling this as the original Misfits because it's not. Doyle is not an original Misfit. But then I looked at the sign again. And it says the original Misfits, Glenn Danzig and Jerry only with Doyle Von Frankenstein. Yeah. And so I guess they're arguing that Danzig and Jerry only together are the original Misfits and the other people are just featured musicians, which actually kind of does make it the original Misfits, even though Jerry only isn't technically an original Misfit. But I guess that's nitpicking. And so if you see it, say the original Misfits are strictly Glenn Danzig and Jerry and not Doyle, but Doyle is a featured musician with the original Misfits, I guess it's truth in advertising.
The other thing about this is I think these are going to be – tickets are going to be even more sought after because Alkaline Trio aren't touring that much. I mean, what's his name? Is doing all those Blink-182 shows now. So so this is
– And actually, Ricky, bring up – oh, go ahead, Ricky.
Oh, I was just trying to think of his – why am I blanking on his name?
Skiba.
So
it also brings up another. Do the Misfits even need an opener at all? I mean, do they just have an opener because? And actually, here's another question: is, you know, these are $150 tickets. When you go see Billy Joel, when you go see Paul McCartney, it's like $200, $300. But they play for 3 hours. The Misfits aren't going to pay for 3 hours. Maybe that's why they have openers because they're only going to play for like 50 minutes.
Like, you need an opener, but you can't do it. Even if you find one that is going to be stylistically in the ballpark that you want, if you're a band with like this much history, it's never going to be unawkward. So like I saw the Sex Pistols once, and the openers for the Sex Pistols were the Reverend Horton Heat and the Dropkick Murphys.
Really?
Right? Which was cool in that I got to watch Reverend Horton Heat and the Dropkick Murphys, which is fine. But it was weird in that it was opening for the Sex Pistols. Like, just that you're never going to put together a show with one of these like reunited, you know, original era punk bands and find anything that's not going to be just like a weird curiosity as the opener.
Yeah. I mean, I think having openers for this are fine. I think Fear was a great touch. I think isn't Discharge opening, the LA show. I mean,
I think you're right.
So I think what's right. Cool is like, it's kind of like, yeah, it's kind of like the old school punk stuff, but then kind of the new, and then they have like one other band that's sort of on the newer side of things.
But you know that like they're never, the Misfits aren't going to get on stage and Glenn's not going to walk up to the mic and say like, let's hear it for the Alkaline Trio. Yeah,
that's true.
They were pretty good. Eh? All right. Like that's not going to happen. The Misfits are going to go on stage as if they've basically like emerged from a pod, and there will be no acknowledgement of whoever was for them. You could have the fucking Ice Capades open.
You know, for $150, I don't think it's too much to ask for one or two other bands. I mean, if it's just $150 just for the Misfits, that's pretty steep. But at least you're getting Fear and you're getting Alkaline Trio. I think that's pretty cool.
All right, one more story here that we'll get through before the next song, and then I don't know. Then we're gonna have to roll the dice and decide how much of the rest of the show we're gonna do because we're like over an hour into this right now. But this one's important. So, this past weekend, soul singer Charles Bradley passed away at the age of 68. He died of stomach cancer. He was initially diagnosed last year, but he had appeared to be beating the disease. But earlier this month, he stated that his prognosis had gotten worse. So his reps have asked that, you know, in lieu of flowers or any of the usual stuff, that donations be made to the All Stars Project and Music Unites in Charles Bradley's honor. So he was touring in support of his Changes album. And he had recently performed over here in our punk rock world at the punk rock bowling event in Asbury Park, New Jersey. So you can find some more info over on Punk News. You can go check out his video for Changes. John, I'm curious about this. Tell me if this is just me or not. I feel that I'd gone for so long in my life without hearing too much about Charles Bradley. Like, I never intersected with him, at least knowingly, But then in the past few years, like Punk Rock Bowling included, he's been like all over my scene, like all over the kind of stuff that I listen to. And was there some rediscovery of Charles Bradley by like the rock music people? Like what, how did that, or is that just my perception?
The whole thing with Charles Bradley is he was around for like 30 years, but no one gave a crap about him. And then Daptone Records put out his record and he became a huge hit, or a big hit at least. That's in kind of the indie Pitchfork scene. In the punk scene, he was – and like the indie rock scene. So you would see him in like what's the Canadian music magazine? Exclaim. Like he'd be all over that. He wasn't big in the punk scene at all, specifically because when I went to see him at Punk Rock Bowling, if you guys remember, like for the better for Punk Rock Bowling, we were like, here's your Charles Bradley's. Check him out. Here's your Charles Bradley's. Check him out. Like we put a whole lot of energy into that. A lot of other publications put a lot of energy into that. Punk Rock Bowling put a lot of energy into that. I went to the concert. Everyone there was like, who's Charles Bradley? I never even heard of this guy. I'm like, how do you not know who he is? He's been plastered all over everything with a specific point of getting you to know who he is. Then he comes out, and it was one of the most beautiful concerts I've ever seen, or beautiful sets I've ever seen. I never saw James Brown or any of those guys, because most of those guys were retired or passed away by the time I started going to concerts. Charles Bradley came out and delivered one of those performances, you know, genuine, raw, very raw, not perfect, but soulful, raw, honest soul. And it was so beautiful. He did an extended version of Black Sabbath Changes. And what I thought was most interesting, whether or not you agree with the message, he had a openly, explicitly spiritual message in his version of Changes, which was 20 minutes long, at Punk Rock Bowling, where everyone's got, you know, upside down crosses and Satan and Baphomets and stuff. And the people loved it and clapped it. And he got one of the biggest receptions of the entire festival. That just goes to show, if you don't agree with the message, how good of a performer he was. And I'm so happy I got to see him at least once. He was amazing. People say, oh, a lot of times stuff gets hyped and it's really not that good. He really was as good as the hype said.
You know, I hadn't heard of him until Punk Rock Bowling announced him on the bill. So I just checked him out. I didn't understand the connection. I didn't, but you know, I'm not hating on it.
There is no connection between him and punk. There is no connection whatsoever between him and punk rock. Yeah.
Adam, should I play a song?
You should. I was just talking and I had my mic muted because my two year old is screaming and I'm like, why is Ricky talking over me?
Sorry.
Anyways, Ricky, hi, I'm Adam. Please play a song. And when we get back, guys, we're going to roll the dice and decide how much more show we're going to do. But we'll see.
Yeah. All right. So Heart Sounds. I got to tell you, I have to thank Sam Barrett for kind of pushing this band, because I was kind of, you know, half and half with them. Then I kind of looked into them a lot more, and I really like them. I saw they put out a 20 minute long one track album called Dualistic Nihilistic Out Through Creator Destructor a couple months ago. I saw them in Ventura and they were really good. It's like the third time I've seen them. They've opened for Wilhelm Scream and Hot Water Music before. So those are the other times I saw them. So I'm not going to play, I'm pretty sure we haven't played a song by them yet on the podcast. I'm not going to play the full 20 minute song, but I will, but I do want to play an older song of theirs, just to kind of get them out there. So this song is called A Total Separation of the Self, from Heart Sounds album Internalize. Here it is. I don't even know who I am anymore.
and that was internalized by Heart Sounds. Ricky, good choice on that. Adam White has stepped out. So, Ricky, we'll do a couple of stories, and then if you want to cut it off, we will. We'll cut it off when we want to cut it off. What else can I say? Ricky, of these three stories we've got, what do you want to talk about? Your pick, Ricky's choice.
I'll take the Lillingtons.
Well, take it away, my man.
Okay, so hang on a second. So we got... So New Noise recently premiered the Lillingtons' new song called Zodiac. The track is from their upcoming album called Stella Sapiente, which is due out on October 13th through Fat Records. You can find the song on the Punk embedded in the Punk News article. I pre-ordered this album. I think this is going to be really good. I didn't like this song as much as I enjoyed the first song called Insect Nightmares, but still, this is good stuff. If you like the pop punk Ramones core kind of thing with a little bit more, what's it called? A little bit more riffage from the guitars. If you like the Lillington shtick, if you know it, then this is probably going to be for you for sure. John, I don't know if you had anything to say about it. I thought it was pretty good.
I think Lillington fans will eat this up and it's Lillington's do what the Lillington's do best,
yeah,
if you will.
Sure. That's it. Yeah.
Ricky, are you a Frank Zappa fan?
I am a Frank Zappa fan. Not so much for his music. I mean, I've heard his music before and it's good. I am more of a fan of his fight against the PMRC in the mid-80s.
I'm a big fan of his music too, but I agree that's an interesting and important aspect. I think people are kind of forgetting about that. But the point being is, Ricky, you're lucky he's coming back, and maybe he'll fight against the PMRC again for you. Frank Zappa is back in hologram form following the wake of Holo Dio, Holo Easy, and Holo Tupac. Frank's going to go on tour. It's being organized by his son. Is it Ahmed or Tweezle who's doing this? Ahmed Zappa is organizing it. And basically, Holo Frank is going to be doing all of Joe's Garage, and live musicians are going to be playing with him. And some long-running Zappa members, such as Warren Cucurillo, Steve Vai, Napoleon Murphy Brock, are going to be playing with Holo, Ian Underwood as well, are going to be playing with Holo Zappa on stage. I'm not a fan of the hologram things. I do think it's a little sick. I do think it's a little perverse. The Zappa family doesn't need money, you know, so they don't need, if they needed money, I would say, all right, but they don't need money. They're doing pretty well. And also Ahmet and Dweezil are at war with each other, or they hate each other. Understandably, basically Moon Unit and Dweezil were kind of cut out of the family by Ahmet and Gail Zappa, which was Frank's wife. So it's kind of sad that the whole family's like at odds with each other. But there is a there is a part of me that wants to go see this just because I never got to see Frank Zappa live. So it would be something. But I think at the end, it's probably going to be an empty experience, and it's kind of ghoulish.
Yeah, I think I'm not into this at all. I think this is a very weird thing. I don't even think, you know what? I don't even think Frank Zappa would be for this. I think he'd hate this, wouldn't he?
I would guess so, but Frank Zappa is, you know, tricky to determine what, because, you know, sometimes Frank Zappa, he didn't always tell, like in interviews, he didn't always tell the truth. Sometimes he was combative simply to be the combative, you know?
Well, still, like, so. I don't know. This is kind of morbid, and I'm not really, I mean, how much do they charge for shows like this?
I think a lot. I think probably like $100.
That's
bucks
not worth
like
it. I'm sorry. Like to see a light of the person performing. I mean, I don't think that's worth it. I think this is just kind of weird. I'm kind of hoping this fad just kind of goes away, because it's not disrespectful, but it's bordering it, you know?
Yeah. I actually thought it was going to go away because Holo Tupac and Holo Easy, like, I think everyone kind of thought it was cheesy, you know?
Yeah.
But, well, I agree. But I don't know, man. Is there any Holo shows you would go see?
No.
I'm trying to think. I'm trying to think of Ricky's favorite. Well, all of Ricky's favorite bands are still touring. Would you go see Holo Pairs, even if the real Pairs is still touring? Like, if there was two Pairs, like real Pairs and Holo Pairs, would you go see Holo Pairs?
No, I mean, would you? I mean, if they did a hologram Johnny Cash Elvis show mixed together,
probably.
Yeah,
not.
I mean,
but I would have loved to see Johnny Cash.
What if? Oh God, this would be fucking heresy in my opinion. But But what if they did this for Joe Strummer?
Oh, that's a good question. Let's find out to the listeners. Would you go see Holo Joe Strummer? That's the biggest show I regret not going to, was Joe Strummer.
Or Darby Crash.
Holo Darby Crash. Just lays in the ground. Yeah.
Someone buy me a beer.
So here's what you do with holograms is you use them in unexpected ways for prank purposes.
Sure.
So you don't have a show where like, come see Holo, come see Holo Elvis, right? You don't want to do that. What you do is you just like, you set it up so that like all of a sudden in like a busy downtown night, fucking Holo Elvis just appears on a rooftop and belts one out and then vanishes. And everyone's like, what the fuck was that? And that's it.
Do people know it's Holo Elvis or people think it's actually Elvis?
Well, he would be 60 feet tall and glowing.
Mm-hmm. So it's like Ghostbusters Elvis.
My concept of these hologram people is that they're all fucking enormous. And if they're not, I am severely disappointed in this whole endeavor. I'm okay with desecrating the memory of the dead for a profit, but only if they're gigantic.
I do think it's somewhat gruesome, if you will, that Dweezil Zappa was touring as Zappa Plays Zappa, which is truth, and that Dweezil Zappa is playing Frank Zappa, and Ahmet Zappa fought a lawsuit against him and made him stop. I think that was really lame.
My understanding of both Zappa and hologram technology is not enough to give anything other than my flippant opinion on this.
Do you think we could do a hologram episode of the podcast where we have holograms of us on the podcast?
You mean everything that we say is hollow and vapid and not worth your money? Yeah, we could probably do that. But what you can't do, John, is you can't avoid a good sleep. And if you need a good sleep, you can get one with Casper. See, Casper, John, is a different kind of mattress. First of all, they ship it to you in a little tiny box, and when you open it, it just sucks in all of the air in your house, suffocating you and your family. And as you die on the floor, deprived of oxygen and that lifeblood that keeps you going, you'll at least know that should you have lived, you would have had just the right sink and just the right bounce.
And if you want to write about it, let me suggest that you get a Squarespace blog and just type in Adam Ricky John in the microphone bar, and you'll get 10% off your next Squarespace website.
But blogging makes you hungry, and who wants to cook? But you have to go buy all these things and cut them, and there's waste. So why not get Blue Apron? Blue Apron will send you the ingredients, Ricky, and you don't even need to know how to cook. You just dump all everything that they send you. You dump it in a bowl, and you just fucking microwave that bowl, and you know, like perfect turkey dinner right out of the fridge. It's amazing.
This is the only
buy bullshit collector. Buy bullshit collector. Put out by punknews.org. Real quick,
I mean, if you're a regular listener, then you know. I've been doing kind of like bonus interview episodes. I just want to give a quick plug. I did three interviews in person at It's Not Dead Fest in late August. I talked with Trevor Riley from Wilhelm Scream, Spike Slauson from Me First and the Gimme Gimmies, and the most recent one was with Scott and Chris from the Flatliners. Those are all out. They're kind of in between each episode. So if you want to, so that's about an hour's worth of interviews that I did for you guys. So give them a listen. Write in, tell us how you like them. I'm definitely open to suggestions. There's also some good tunage, and and some funny stuff, especially on the Flatliners one. That was a good that one was a really good time. So give those a listen.
This has been a Valor Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or, you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at greg@valorundergroundstudios.com.